Hey, before we get started, I want to tell you about three services that I use. First, do you know who hosts my site? WP Engine. They ensure my site stays up, they make backups in case anything happens to my data, and they help me avoid having my site hacked again. It happened to me last year, but not anymore, because now I'm with WPEngine.com. Second, do you know about the WPValet.com? They're like my outsourced CTO. When I have trouble with a plugin, they fix it. If I need new code written, they can do it. If my computer breaks, well, they can't do that. But they do run WordPress sites like nobody else. They run them like that smart tech co-founder you always wish you had. So go to thewpvalet.com. Finally, when I needed an agreement written recently, you know who I used? Walker Corporate Law. Walker Corporate Law is the firm that founders use when they raise money or when they're selling their businesses, but Walker Corporate Law helps me with any legal issue I have, or they refer me to someone who can. So when you start up, go to Walker Corporate Law and have them in your corner as you grow your business. All right, let's get started. Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, home of the ambitious upstart, and I'm recording the first interview in my new office here. Not fully set up, it's looking a little dark. Kind of like I'm back to looking like a hostage here with the light on me. But I came here and specifically opened the office because I wanted to do this interview. I was really eager for this one. Today I've got with me best-selling author Tim Ferriss, who is back with a new book called The 4-Hour Chef. The simple path to cooking like a pro, learning anything, and living the good life. And it's that middle part that I'm especially curious about. The learning anything. How does Tim do it? How does he learn rapidly? Tim, welcome.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Languages especially. In fact, is it languages where you first discovered this system for learning quickly?
Yeah, it was, absolutely. So when I was 15, I'd already failed at Spanish. I had tried Spanish. I was required to take Spanish for a few years, couldn't string sentences together, and then had the opportunity to go to Japan as an exchange student. And what I hadn't really been told, I thought I was going to have private language classes, but I ended up just going to school with 5,000 Japanese students. So going to physics and Kobun, which is like ancient Japanese, with Japanese students. So I ended up.
You thought you were going to go learn Japanese, but instead you were going to be in a school where learning would go on in different topics in Japanese.
Right. So the lost in translation was, "Don't worry," because I was worried. "Don't worry, you will have Japanese classes every day." But what they meant was you'll be going to normal high school Japanese classes that students are using to cram for college. And I ended up, so I had to do something different, because the usual approach hadn't worked for me with Spanish, so it wasn't going to work with Japanese. So I used comic books, an electronic dictionary, and judo textbooks, actually, to learn the grammar, as well as a wall poster, a single poster that has all the common use characters on it, 1,945. So it started with trying to figure out this seemingly insurmountable language, Japanese. That's how it all started out.
And so there are 1,945 words that are what? They're common, and so why is that significant?
Well, it's significant because, to me, learning Japanese was this very huge, amorphous task, and I really didn't know how to break it down into manageable pieces, Lego blocks. And I was actually in the process of potentially going home. I was about to quit, throw in the towel, because all the other students had. There were a couple who came from New Zealand, Malaysia, another student from the U.S. They had all already gone home. And I went to Kinokuniya bookstore in Shinjuku in Tokyo, and I was looking for the Book of Five Rings in English, which is a great book. But next to it, I saw this rolled up poster that had the common usage characters. What that means is, to facilitate literacy in Japan, the newspapers, magazines, and whatnot limit the characters that they use to these common use characters, 1,945. So for me, that turned into a representation of Japanese in one page. And so I put it on the back of my bedroom door, and that became my target.
And how long did it take you to learn that and be able to have a conversation with the stranger in the street?
It took me about 11 months to feel comfortable speaking, reading, and writing Japanese. And what I think is important to note, number one, I had determined I was bad at languages prior to that. So it wasn't a reflection of my innate ability. It was the method. It was the recipe, so to speak. And as I refined that over time, I next did Mandarin Chinese. And it took about 6 months that time around to get to the same level of proficiency. And then a few years later, actually in 2005, tackled German, and that took 3 months. And then I tackled Spanish again, the first one I had failed with, in Argentina, and it took 8 weeks to get to the highest level of the University of Buenos Aires testing for Spanish. So it was just the method. The method was more refined.
And it seems to me that the first part of this method is to break down the tough topic and figure out what are those key elements that have outsized power. In your case, yep. It was finding the poster with the 1945 characters, which you still right. have today and is in the book, The 4-Hour Chef, which is kind of cool. But how do we do that? How do we break something down and come up with those essential pieces?
A big part of it is looking for the anomalies, whether it's in language learning. For instance, if it were language learning, I won't spend all too much time on language learning, but I like talking about it because it's so intimidating to most people. And it doesn't take a lifetime to get good at a language. It's total nonsense. It doesn't. I mean, in 12 weeks with even a complicated language, you can become very, very, very good. With language, it has to do with looking for outliers. An example would be like Daniel Tammet, who's a very skilled mnemonist and mind athlete. So he learned Icelandic well enough in 7 days to go on television and be interviewed. It's like, how do you do that? He also memorized pi to a few thousand digits. It's like, how do you do that? Well, there are tricks to doing both of those things, or memorizing decks of cards. So I want to, rather than throw the baby out with the bathwater, by just looking for where people clump, and it's like, oh, well, most people do this, therefore it's the best approach, which is very commonly done, even in analysis like the 10,000 hour rule and stuff. I think that that's very commonly done. I'm going to look for the oddities. So, you know, the high school girl who can deadlift 450 pounds for repetitions, but still looks like a normal girl. Like that's odd to me. I'm going to try to replicate it. Or swimming, an example for swimming, because I couldn't swim until a few years ago, and I was terrified of it. I'd given up. And then I had stakes, which we can talk about later, but a friend of mine signed me a 1 kilometer open water race as my New Year's resolution. And I gave him his, which is a great way to do resolutions, by the way. You don't pick your own. And so mine to him was no stimulants stronger than green tea for the rest of the year. And he was doing like 8 double espressos a day. But Terry Lachlan and total immersion is a method of swimming that is quite the opposite from almost everything else. You don't do workouts. You barely kick. You don't even practice breathing until you've mastered all of these other drills. And it removed all of the failure points for swimming for me. So a big part of it is looking for the anomalies and knowing how to find them and ask for them. So if it's, let's say, ultra running, when I talk to some of the best ultra runners in the world, they're built like spiders. They're designed for it. So I would ask them, you know, who's really good at this, who shouldn't be? Whether they're really old or really fat or really big, whatever it is. And then you start to look at these unconventional athletes, performers, whatever it is, and look at if it's replicable. You know, a mistake that I think a lot of people make, and then I'll stop because I get all amped up about this.
Do it.
One of the common mistakes that people make when they're trying to become really good at something is they say, all right, I want to be good at swimming. I'm going to emulate whoever.
Michael Phelps.
Or I want to be good at golf. I'm going to emulate Tiger Woods. And it's important to realize that people at that level often succeed despite how they train, not because of it. And I know top NFL athletes, like, you know, 8-pack abs, and they eat McDonald's for breakfast, Burger King for lunch, Wendy's for dinner. Like, total garbage. Secondly, what people use to go from like zero, baseline, ground zero, to really good, like world class, which to me is top 5% in the world, is very different and I think more instructive than what they do once they're at the top. So this is a mistake that people make in the investment world a lot. Is they'll look at somebody who already has $100 million, who's a VC now, and they're like, well, let me emulate how he invests. I'm like, no, you don't want to do that. You want to look at how he went from having, you know, $100,000 net worth to $1 million net worth. Look at that first. Then you can look at 1 million to 10 million. But don't start off emulating like what Richard Branson's doing now. Read, you know, Losing Your Virginity and look at what he did when he was in the beginning.
So you're an investor in tech startups.
Yeah.
You understand the space. If we were going to, say, want to build a successful tech startup, Should we look at Mark Zuckerberg and say, how did he get there? Or should we ask the question that you asked a moment ago, which is, who's great at this startup thing? Who shouldn't be?
It depends on, that's a good question. So it depends on what our objective is. So if our objective is to emulate specific CEOs to, let's just say, increase personal net worth, there's one approach. If you want to create a highly profitable startup, there's yet another approach. If you want to create a startup that returns money to investors, it's yet another approach, right? Because you can make a ton of money as a startup CEO in the Silicon Valley game just by raising a lot of money. And then if you're the hottest girl at the dance and everybody wants to invest, you say, well, I'd love to do it with you, but I need to take some money off the table. So can you buy 30% of my stock so I can put $10 million in the bank or whatever? Happens every day, right? But that's a very different approach than perhaps going after creating a highly profitable company that is self-sustaining, like Evernote, for instance. I mean, Evernote is wildly successful. They have millions of paying customers. But Phil, I think, is a great example CEO, Phil Libman, of a fascinating CEO, because he's not like a bombastic guy who gets up there like Larry Ellison. He is not you know, win at all costs, place everything on the line. He's very methodical. He plans it out. He tracks his cohort analysis, obviously, with his entire team. And there are many different ways to skin the cat. So I think it's looking at the anomalies is very, very helpful, in so much as the best practices are very seldom the most common. So absolutely.
So you're saying, first of all, there are lots of different kinds of entrepreneurs. They're the ones who keep raising money. They're the ones who are profitable and so on. Pick the one that's most similar to where I want to be and then look for that anomaly.
Yeah, okay. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And that goes for marketing. It goes for ad campaigns. Certainly like PETA, right? I mean, before PETA started using naked celebrities, I mean, there's a lot to be said for naked celebrities, but it's like they use naked women in their ads all the time to get their point across, right?
Yeah.
And not that everyone should suddenly emulate that, although the world might be a more beautiful place for it. There are always exceptions to the rule that can be replicated. And in the case of whether it's becoming CEO and building a company, whether it's losing body fat, creating a best-selling book, whatever it might be, there are really three things, I think, that determine outcome when you're choosing methods. So the least important is it efficient? Is the method efficient? Is it a good use of time? The second most important is it effective? Like, if I actually do it, will it produce the outcome that I want? Right? So effective is doing the right things. The most important is adherence. And all that means is, will you actually do it at the end of the day? And people fail all the time with, let's say, fat loss, because they're told by whomever, you know, fill in the blank expert, they're like, all right, you need to work out at least an hour a day, minimum four times a week. And it's too inconvenient. As soon as they have to pick up the kids or do overtime work or whatever, they miss their hour, then they feel they have to do 2 hours the next day, and then they quit. Whereas you have to pick the method that you will follow first and foremost, and then you can look at whether it's effective, whether it's efficient. So for fat loss, for instance, you know, the minimum effective dose, which you can apply to everything, including language, shooting basketballs, playing billiards, whatever, is 30 grams of protein, 30 minutes, within 30 minutes of waking up. And, you know, that's how my dad lost his first, he went from 5 pounds of average fat loss per month to 18.75, and then ultimately lost more than 100. You start with tiny little tweak instead of something really big, which is prone to abandonment.
You talked about steaks earlier and the importance of having steaks.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that, and how do we find the right steak?
So steaks are insurance against human nature. So you need a carrot or a stick to compel you to do what you know you should do. And all that means is, if you don't do your job and you're an employee, you get fired. There's a consequence to not doing your job. If you don't follow your diet, really not much happens. You just stay fat or whatever. But there is no punishment, let's say, and there's frequently not much of a reward other than looking incrementally better over time.
And like a lot of things in life, the punishment and the reward are in the future.
Yeah, exactly. And as you know, humans are terrible with dealing with the future, whether it's predicting what'll make them happy or like health doesn't get anyone to do anything. I mean, right. Really, it's amazing. Like, you see people who've had a heart attack 2 months prior, and they're like eating donuts and smoking cigarettes because it's just, it's too abstract and off in the future. So I'll give you a real tactical approach to steaks. You can just go to a website like stick.com, S-T-I-C-K-K.com, which is based on research done by a Yale professor. And it was supposed to be a commitment store. That was the idea. It was going to be a commitment store online. And here's how it works. Mm-hmm. You take some amount of money that is, you know, decent to you. I recommend 1% of your sort of pre-tax income is a good, okay, is a good starting point. And you put it into escrow and you set your goal and you tell, you explain what you're going to do, like, you know, whatever it is, 30 grams within 30 minutes of waking up or exercising twice a week, whatever, writing a chapter a day. And then you have a referee who's like a friend or someone else who will keep you honest. And if you then choose an anti-charity, so this is a charity you would rather die than give money to this charity. The current most effective one is the George W. Bush Congressional Library. And if you don't follow your program, your money in escrow goes to that charity and you are on the record publicly as having donated that money. And people make incredible changes when that happens. They really make incredible changes. And you can create a wiki and then just smack talk among your friends, and let's say weigh in, which is what Ramit Sethi did, and ended up, he was a, you know, skinny Indian guy, had trouble gaining weight, had a goal of, I think, 15 pounds of muscle in 6 months, and he did it in 3 months, as soon as he set up those stakes, you know, the risk of public humiliation. There are a lot of people who do it. Money is a simple way.
You know what? I've done the one that you talked about earlier with swimming, where I'll sign myself up for a race if I'm not running enough, and I know that I now have paid for this race. I've got it coming up. It's a long one, and unless I train, I'm really going to suffer and embarrass myself there. I also have found that for business, it helps me to have stakes because, you know, if I can go and get a job, if this business doesn't work out, then maybe I'm not so eager to make it work out. Maybe I want the safety and the comfort of a job sometimes. But if everything goes to pot and I go bankrupt, if my business goes south, then I'm really going to work hard. Yeah. And make sure that that doesn't happen. But here's the thing that I've noticed when I talked about this publicly on Mixergy. Some people will say, hey, you know what? It freaks me out. I get to a level where the stakes are so high, I get freaked out and I don't do anything. So yeah. What do you do about that?
No, that's a good question. So I think there's a minimum effective dose, right? And the dose makes the poison. So it's the stakes that you choose have to be enough. Mm-hmm. To incentivize you to do what you need to do, but in some, not so much that you're a constant anxious mess. And I think that it's very comparable to investing. You know, how much are you comfortable being down in a given quarter? 10%, 25%, 50%, and assessing that very carefully. So it doesn't have to necessarily be a lot of money. I have a friend at Google, Trevor, who partnered up with one of his friends. And they became accountable for going to the gym. And if either of them skipped, they had to pay the other person, I think it was $10, something super nominal. But it was enough to trigger the psychology where they both felt compelled to go. And Trevor ended up losing a ton of weight, running a marathon, under 200 pounds for the first time since college, all because of this ridiculously small $10 wager. I do agree that if you look at the broad spectrum of startups, now there's a difference between having a profitable business and having a successful venture-backed Silicon Valley startup. They're fundamentally very different. I think that there's a lot to be said for moonlighting while still employed, testing the waters, ensuring that you have a model you think works that is generating revenue, and then jumping in feet first, not head first, feet first. But if you look at, for instance, Y Combinator and how they pick companies, or I should say pick founders, people to participate in Y Combinator, they don't like people who are doing a bunch of things part-time because they don't have that hunger, that drive, that survival instinct to really go all in with what they're doing.
If you were to go all in and find, well, actually, has this happened to you? Gone all in and said, whoa, this is way too much. It's now at a place where I can't focus on what I need to do because the stakes are so high. I'm worried about losing it all. I'm worried about people seeing me suffer a setback. Have you ever gotten to that place?
Some variation of it, sure. I mean, this book, I mean, so look at the width of this thing. I mean, it's, you know, it's 672 pages, and that's after cutting 250 pages. And it's a choose your own adventure book and whatnot. But I had not been to the breaking point since about 2000. And this book took me to the absolute breaking point.
Why?
Because it was, I did something that I thought would make a very interesting story. And that was start from ground zero and show people all my insecurities and fears about cooking and inability with cooking, and then have them watch me go through the whole process of learning it, start to finish, and how I apply all these different things that can also apply the language and sports and everything. Turns out that taking something that should take 3 years, compressing it into 6 months because of my deadline with Amazon Publishing, while trying to learn the skill that you're writing about, is really stressful. Who would have thought? And I mean, there were days where I just wanted to curl up on the ground and do nothing, or like stay in bed. I mean, I really did not want to get up and face what I had to do that day. And that was related to stakes. But I would say that for any entrepreneur, right, an entrepreneur is like emprender, to undertake, to make things happen. For anyone who wants to make things happen, there's an element of risk and there's an element of fear, always. Read Letters from a Stoic. It's a short book written by Seneca like 2,000 years ago. And Seneca was not, he wasn't the Roman equivalent of like a motivational speaker, which a lot of philosophers were. They just like sit on a porch and philosophize and eat grapes and do nothing. Like Seneca was an advisor to the emperor, richest investment banker in Rome, one of the most famous playwrights. He got a lot of shit done. And Stoicism as an operating system teaches you to not have overly emotional responses to negative things. It allows you to condition yourself that way, train yourself, and to also not be completely attached ego-wise with things that are outside of your control. So I think that to create stakes but not be paralyzed by them, it's really helpful to just do a little bit of reading on Stoic philosophy.
And really, is that what you did? So when you were at the place where you said, maybe this book isn't going to get published, it's too much work, it's taking me away from other stuff, these are the thoughts that you had. Yeah. How did you snap out of it? And I ask because I'm looking at some of the personal emails that I'm getting from people, and they say that they have this issue, that they have an undertaking that's so big that they're overwhelmed, they don't know what to do, and they just don't end up doing anything. So what did you do to get yourself past that?
A few things. So the first was reread Letters from Stoic. I also reread multiple times my highlights from a book called Bird by Bird, which covers all of the psychology of writing, and I think of creativity really well, all the self-doubt and so forth. I also did two things that I do very consistently across all the books and just in life in general. Number one was have a consistent exercise schedule. You have to get out of your head and take at least a 30-minute vacation from your mental tail chasing just to see things clearly.
Okay.
So having a consistent exercise program is really critical for mental performance and general well-being and sleep and so forth. The last thing is 80-20 analysis, 80-20, 80-20, 80-20 constantly. So what are the 20% of all of these thousands of pages that I have in research? What is the 20% that's going to deliver 80% or more of the value to my readers? What are they actually going to do? Like, I might have fallen in love with this one section about a real example, Georges St. Pierre. So GSP, the UFC fighter, had multiple pages on it, like a 24-hour schedule to the calorie, exactly what he eats, exactly how his personal chefs make it. Fascinating to me at the end of the day, not useful to enough people in my readership to go in the book. It'll end up somewhere else, but I had to make those cuts. So I did 80-20 analysis over and over and over again. Also, I was working with a big team for this book. I mean, I assembled like a really elite team of people all over the planet to help put it together. I mean, dozens of photographers, like more, at least a dozen photographers, illustrators, on and on and on. And there were certain people among them who were very stressful to deal with and who made things worse. So to analyze also the 20% of people or activities that are creating 80%+ of my stress, consuming 80%+ of my time. And as is almost always the case, the stuff that was consuming the most time did not overlap very much with the 20% that was most important. And so not just doing that when I felt like it, but scheduling that type of 80-20 analysis, let's say every Monday or every Friday, so that you have that as a practice, I think is very
important. So on a regular schedule, you'll sit and do that 80-20 analysis and ask yourself, what's the 20% of my life that's getting me the most impact, the 80% impact, and how do I stop doing the rest?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's a little bit in between that can go either way. So I'll look at the 20% that are the highest leverage positive things, and I'll focus on those. Mm-hmm. I'll look at then the 20% most negative things that are consuming the most time and try to eliminate those. There's quite a bit in between that in the end often takes care of itself, but really keeping the eye on the ball of the to-do list for the 80-20 positive and the not to-do list for the 80-20 negative is huge. And when I'm really feeling overwhelmed, I actually focus on the negative, which is a good thing. I focus on eliminating as much as possible before I focus on doing more. Like, what can I get rid of? What are the psychic anchors that are like tethering me to the ground where I'm trying to sprint forward, but I'm just dragging this big weight behind me? Like, what are those things that
So
I
what's
can
an
remove?
example of something like that, of something that as you looked at yourself and you looked at your life, you thought, this is an anchor. It's clearly weighing me down. Do you have an example of something like that that you discovered, and what'd you do?
Startup investing. So I'm very fortunate. I mean, I have a lot of I work with a lot of wonderful startups, and I take my responsibilities to those startups very seriously. I mean, I really want to be the most valuable advisor or investor for every single one of my startups. But that requires a lot of attention. And I'm fortunate to get great deal flow. I see a lot of really interesting startups from people I trust, people I like.
I bet.
And it was very easy to feel like I was missing opportunities if I turned that off. I was missing these amazing opportunities. What if that's one of the 15 startups per year that's the big deal? Like, I have to pay attention to this. I really need to look at this deck and that deck and talk to this guy and have this lunch. And it was interrupting my writing. And it was causing me a lot of stress, even though it was a good thing, right? It was problems are still problems. It's like you never get rid of all your problems. You trade up. And not complaining about it, but it was causing me a lot of stress. And so I'd have like, hey man, did you get back to that startup I introduced you to? Like, it's really important, time sensitive, closing in a day. And it was really stressing me out. So I had to just say, look, I'm taking a break until 2013 on investing stuff. Like, I'm done. And I would love to talk then if it's still relevant. But otherwise, like, I wish you all the best. I just don't have the bandwidth. I have to focus on the one Archimedes lever that is most important to me, and that is making sure this book is better than my, not just as good as, but better than my last two books, and that I get it out to the people who can use it best, who need it most. And
So,
it was really, really hard.
yes, that's what I imagine it would be. I'm glad you're saying that because for anyone who's listening to us who's flooded with extra work that they don't want to do, they would like to be able to say to the people they're working with, I'm not going to handle this. I need to just say no to this for now and I could come back to it in the future. But the big hesitation around it is that someone's going to say, hey, come on, you're making too big a deal out of it. Keep it simple. Or how we're going to feel admitting setback. I mean, I could put myself in your shoes and say, all these other investors would probably say, Tim doesn't have enough time to invest. We're all angel investors here. If Mr. Productivity doesn't have enough time, then maybe he's not productive enough, or maybe he doesn't understand the start. Anyway, so how do you get
No.
past those things? Boy, and what an echo in this room.
No, it's
This
it's like Al Jazeera. I love it. Well, no, like what
Especially with
you
the two
said.
random spikes over my head.
Yeah, like you said, the hostage video. But so a few things I would say is that the reason that I make those decisions, let's say about angel investing, is because I want to be methodical. So it's not because I don't have the time. This is really important. It's because I don't have the attention, right? So it's like, do you have the time technically, right, to have like your mom call you every 45 minutes to talk for 45 seconds? Yeah, sure. If you add that up over the day, it's like, what, 15 minutes, 20 minutes? Sure, whatever, you know, and less. Like, you have the time, but you can't spare, you do not have the attention to tolerate those interruptions. And that's the difference. So I want to be very methodical in how I invest, and that's why I tend not to lose money when I invest, is I try to follow my rules. Anyway, where I was going with that is the only way that I've been able to say no to these things is really based, it's not a new website, it's not a new tool, it's really a philosophical decision. And I keep on using this term operating system, but based on stoicism. So the first is to get the big good things done, you have to let small bad things happen. There's no way around it. You can't, if you try to prevent all mistakes, all offense that people take, all whatever it might be, you know, penalties for late payments on everything, this, that, and the other thing, you will be a master of minutiae until the day you die. You have to get good at letting the little bad things happen or wait so that you can get the big things done. Number one. Number two, and this was for me something that became really important in the last 6 months especially, is if you feel you cannot become defensive with opportunities where you feel like you have to grasp at every opportunity or you're going to miss the big opportunity, the big shot. You instead need to believe, to function, to be a very high functioning entrepreneur or person, you need to believe that you can create opportunities at will. That even if you miss the big startup of the year, who cares? Because there's going to be 15 more next year. And if you get one of those right, you can make millions. If you, however, feel like you have to grab at everything and take a spray and pray approach, you're going to lose a lot of money, guaranteed. So to not feel rushed and to be confident in your ability to create opportunities. And this is a problem you see with a lot of entrepreneurs, inventors, self-described inventors a lot. Like they have their one idea and they need everybody to sign 10 NDAs because like if you steal my idea, I'll never have another idea.
Yep.
If that's their position, they're never going to be able to make that one idea work to start with. You have to have the confidence that you, as an entrepreneur, can make things happen and create opportunity.
What's an example of an opportunity that you made for yourself recently? And I ask because I imagine, this is Tim Ferriss. Opportunities just must be available to him. He doesn't have to make them.
Oh, yeah, that's not true. So I'm really good at writing my own bio. And so it sounds really fancy and like, oh, I've done all these amazing things. Well, I screw up all the time. I mean, I couldn't swim until a few years ago. I was afraid of basketball, humiliated. Like, I have all the insecurities that everybody else has. But I have systems for compensating for them. So in terms of creating opportunity, all right, here's a very current example. Mm-hmm. So Barnes & Noble is boycotting the 4-Hour Chef because it's the first major acquisition of Amazon Publishing. So
Is it just Barnes & Noble or no, all?
Many. It's many. It's not all. There are a handful who are carrying it and all the rest are boycotting it. And this is problem. It's not problematic in some ways, and it's very problematic in other ways. So if I want to hit the New York Times bestseller list, I need retail distribution. You have to have at least some, and I'll have a little bit, but I don't know if it's enough. And the New York Times is a black box. They don't tell you how it's all calculated. Wall Street Journal, BookScan, that's straight numbers. That's easy to understand. But so for the New York Times, like, of course I want to hit the New York Times. We'll see if I can. And so, for instance, this is actually, in a way, it's kind of fun for me because I'm like returning back to my really, really early scrappier days.
Uh-huh.
So I crashed a party recently in New York City for Target. I actually flew to New York and did this. It was a 50th anniversary Target party, and I crashed it. I was like friend of a friend, got in, and went looking for like the top executives, CTOs, whoever, CMOs, whoever I can get a hold of to basically make the pitch for like trying to get the book into Target. Which is not easy because they've already eliminated the Kindle. They're not carrying the Kindle very purposefully. So it's like, oh man, like how am I going to make this happen? You know, it's like, well, get on a plane. It's time to pitch, you know, always be closing. Better sharpen your skills. And I've been doing a lot of that kind of stuff for this book, which, you know, on one hand is really tiring, right? Because it's like boiler room all over again. On the other hand, it's like a dog fight. Like I like dog fights. Okay, I'll fight.
So are you in Target now as a result of that?
In process. So
okay.
Remains to be seen. I think that it's an uphill battle. Until this book hopefully does incredibly well and it's sort of ubiquitous online and then that online turns into radio and TV and then that obviously bleeds into print. And then eventually, if the profit seems high enough, I think that people who are currently in a gray area where they're not officially boycotting but they're not carrying could end up carrying. So it's part of starting that conversation. But there's the distinct possibility, the high likelihood that I will fail in getting the book into Target. Part of the game, you know? It's like, so who do I go after next? Is it Costco? Is it Urban Outfitters? Is it airports? Like, what can I do? And those are opportunities that certainly Amazon Publishing is helping with. HMH, with whom they, so Houghton Mifflin, with whom Amazon partnered for print distribution, is helping. But at the end of the day, like you are responsible for shepherding your product to where you want it to go. No one is going to care about it as much as you do. It's like, great, you hired a publicist. No one is going to care about it as much as you do. So if you're pitching the biggest outlet and it is the game changer, pitch them yourself, you know?
So, and here's one way that you're encouraging people to help you, generate sales because of what's going on with Barnes & Noble. If we buy three books instead of one, what happens?
Okay, so this book, not to do the Vanna White thing again, but this book.
I didn't, by the way, I didn't realize it was that.
It's big. It's big. And it's got, you know, 1,000+ photographs. It's got hundreds of illustrations. It's got Calvin and Hobbes. It's got supermodels. It's got guns. That's something for everybody. Anyway, so the point being, it's a nice holiday book. It's a beautiful book. So if you buy 3 print copies and you send the email receipt, the Amazon email receipt, to 3books@4hourchef.com. So the number 3, books at number 4hourchef.com. I will invite all those 3 book buyers to an exclusive Q&A with me. So 2-hour Q&A after book launch, where I'll grab a bottle of wine and you can ask me anything that you want. So for people who would be interested in that, would love for you to get 3 copies, 2 as gifts, 1 for yourself. And then we can rock on, and you can ask me whatever you want. So that's,
and that includes even the digital version, which is what I, there we go. Which I...
Yeah. If you buy 3 digital versions, I'm not sure if you even can, but you know, send it across and I'm happy to invite you to the Q&A session for sure.
What else was I going to ask you? By the way, here's the thing. I was trying to think of who it was. I think it was Eric Ries who came on here, and I asked him how he got to the bestseller book, to the bestseller list. He told me that he sat down with you and you gave him a few ideas. And I think one of those ideas was to encourage people to bulk buy.
Yeah,
and what I'm wondering is, you did pioneer that. Didn't it bother you that other people were going out and using the same tactic of telling their audiences that if they buy bundles of 10 books, they get accepted into a special place where they can talk? Didn't you feel like, wait, this is what was going to sell my next book and make it a bestseller? You're watering it down.
You know, it's a good question. It doesn't bother me at all. This is related to what we were just talking about. So it doesn't bother me at all for a few reasons. The first is, I really try, and it doesn't always work, but I try to have an abundance mentality where I think that particularly in books, it's not a winner-take-all proposition. You can have many, many winners, right? New York Times list comes out every week and you have multiple categories. So I don't fear that. The second is, I'm going to be doing new stuff. And so I have to be confident in my ability to create new types of promotions so that I'm always ahead of the curve. I have to be confident in that. And if I claw on to all these other things, I think I'll be less successful as a result. So
I have a process for becoming creative. I love how you can break down someone else's process, of course, learn it and use it. Are you able to do that for creativity? Because it feels like creativity is, it's just too, I mean, it can't be forced into process, or can it?
I think you don't want to, force is a strong word, but I think that you can absolutely greatly accelerate creativity with a system for inducing it, right?
Or what's
forcing
the system?
It. So there are a few, Edward de Bono has a lot of really interesting writing, like lateral thinking is quite good. Mm-hmm. There's also something that I was given as a gift from a very successful CEO. And I don't have it in front of me. I wish I did, but I believe it's called the WHACK pack, WHACK pack. And it sounds very obscene, but it's a deck of cards with different creative exercises. So whether it's reversal, and then it gives a little example, like an anecdote, or mixing and matching, it's a really fun way. I used to carry this around with me when I had sticking points for the 4-Hour Chef. Like, I wasn't sure how to format a given section to make it as fun and as actionable as possible. I would go out to dinner with this whack pack and I'd shuffle it, and then I'd go through like the first 10 and write down my notes of my ideas that would generate that way. And then go through the next 10, and then we'd do random games and stuff if I went out with my girlfriend or someone else. It was really, really helpful. So I think that would be one super easy option for that people could play with, at least.
And you just would spring this on your girlfriend or on your friends? Because I feel like a lot of people would be intimidated to let anyone else see this part of them, see that they're trying something, and let alone to bring it into dinner.
Yeah, I do, because I'm playful in that way, and I don't feel like I sacrifice anything by showing my struggles. I don't feel like I sacrifice anything in doing that. And for instance, right now, okay, so struggles, the boycott, everything else. So I've been in the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, cover I found out today of the Miami Herald, all for talking about this challenge. I have no problem talking about it. And I think a lot of good can come out of it. Not the least of which is you make yourself more human, because we're all human. Like, I'm not bulletproof. I'm not always happy and getting, you know, changing the world every day, getting a lot done. No, there are stretches where I get nothing done for like an entire week, and I'm depressed, and I'm like, oh my God, you know, I wake up late and like drinking a little bit too much wine. Like, I have all those issues. The key is having systems so that you can recover. The key is having, you know, a recipe that can get you out of that, and at least ensure that with the few things you do, you're getting the highest leverage possible, the highest output possible. So no, I don't mind. I'm happy to talk about the struggles.
How do you keep track of your systems as you make them up? Do you have a separate Evernote notebook where you put this all in? What do you
Yeah, I do a lot of it with Evernote. So I do have a separate notebook where I keep a lot of my systems. I calendar a lot of it. So whether it's, for instance, watching Steve Jobs' Stay Hungry commencement speech.
Mm-hmm.
I do that every Monday.
Every Monday you watch that?
Yeah, every Monday morning. I have 80-20 analysis I try to do at least biweekly on Fridays. All of my in-person meetings I try to do on Fridays as well. And I tend to batch similar tasks by day, not portions of the day. But I put that all into my calendar because I really want it to be as little of a working memory burden as possible. I don't want to make decisions on things that I shouldn't have to make decisions about, whether that's breakfast, whether that is what my like pregame ritual is for the week on Mondays. I don't want to have to think about it, so it's in my calendar.
You ever feel like this is just a little too much, that this is just, I should just relax and go through life and let whatever happens happen?
Sometimes. I suppose the hilarity of my response to that is that I will schedule that. So I will
schedule time to just do nothing, to not be scheduled.
I'll schedule time to wander. Yeah.
Okay.
And hopefully the entire month of February will be that. So I currently have the entire month of February blocked out, with the exception of one bachelor party for a good friend of mine, blocked out to just disappear and probably focus on a new language like Indonesian, Bahasa, and surfing. But I think that there is a lesson to be learned there. And that is, if your personal time is just what's left over outside of your calendar, mm-hmm. work will encroach to fill that vacuum. And for me, at least, I find it very helpful to block out that time and protect it just like I would an important conference call or a meeting. So to take that personal time, and for instance, like every Tuesday, I try to make it a policy by the end of every Tuesday that I have scheduled really cool stuff to do for the weekend or really relaxing stuff, but like get it on the calendar. So you wake up on a Saturday and you don't have anything planned and you're like, I'll just check email for 10 minutes. That's how you end up checking email for 5 hours.
Yeah.
And then you don't have any weekend, and then you have no recovery time. And then, of course, you're going to crash and burn. So I find it very helpful to put the personal stuff on the calendar and block it out.
So Derek Sivers, the founder of CD Baby, told me about the need to systemize your company. And so I started creating these different systems internally for how to edit an interview. And if we're going to change the editing process, we just go in and improve that step in our case, it's Evernote or WordPress.
Yep.
I started doing the same thing for myself, saying, if I'm going to get up at 6:30, what's the formula for getting up at 6:30? Oh, yeah, it's putting the alarm clock in the other room so that I can't hit snooze and go to bed without thinking about it. It's having a cup of cold coffee ready so that if I have that first sip, I wake up. There's a set of steps, and I'll write them down, and I'll improve them or get rid of things that are extraneous. Is that what you do when you want to improve an area of your life?
Yeah, absolutely. I focus on a massive elimination first. I try to remove as much as possible so that I have fewer moving pieces mm-hmm. to think about. So elimination is a huge part of why I get anything done. And whenever I'm feeling overwhelmed, as cheesy as it might sound, I focus on eliminating clutter in my physical environment, my house. Like if I feel really overwhelmed, first thing I do is I start clearing things off, scanning documents so that I don't have piles of paper, whatever it might be. As a first step. But I do systematize, and there's a lot of really interesting research that's been done through, you know, legitimate institutions and has been covered also in the New York Times and elsewhere about decision fatigue. So it's like if you wake up and every time you wake up, you're like, what should I have for breakfast? Huh? Oh, maybe I'll check email first. Maybe I'll check my texts on my phone first. Well, maybe I should brush my teeth. but yeah, oh wait, no, I forgot to have my vitamins, whatever. And you're doing that every day. You only have a certain number of hit points that you can allocate to decision making. And when you don't have it systematized and you like go to the grocery store and you're like, wow, which one of 100 brands of toothpaste should I buy? And you sit there like, it affects your ability to make good decisions later on the important stuff. So I try to reserve my creativity and decision making for only the areas where it has the biggest impact. So I really believe in the power of ritual and the power of recipes, whether it's applied to waking up in the morning, you know, searing and making the perfect steak, shooting a three-pointer basketball, learning a language. The constraints make you free in a way, which is very paradoxical. But like the constraints really give you incredible freedom.
You mentioned basketball. You use the DIS process, as you call it, to get yourself to a point where you can hit 9 out of 10 free throws, right? What's the DIS process? DISSS.
Yeah, you got it. So it's a helpful acronym. So DISS is just easier to remember than DSSS. And it stands for deconstruction, selection, sequencing, and then stakes. So in simple terms, I'll give an example of each. Deconstruction is taking this amorphous skill, like learning basketball or learning how to shoot a three-pointer, and breaking it down into pieces that are digestible that you can analyze. So let's take swimming, because I couldn't swim until a few years ago, right? Which is embarrassing, having grown up on Long Island. For swimming, you could look at number one, the type of stroke. So then you have how the arms move, how the legs move, the rotation. So putting down a laundry list of different ways that you could break this skill down. And then looking for the anomalies. And there are a whole host of ways you can do this, but who are the people who are good at this who shouldn't be? How are the most controversial coaches training people? What if, and this is a very powerful mechanism, you look at the failure points. So the reasons that I had failed at swimming before, inability to breathe properly, feeling like I was drowning, exhaustion, kicking. I would kick like a drowning monkey with a kickboard, a paddleboard, and I wouldn't go anywhere. And I'd be like, ah, I'm out of here. This is humiliating. I'm done. Over and over again. It's like, what if I had to swim without kicking? Is there a way to do it? So you go on Google, go on YouTube, look for different methods. And at the end of the day, I found total immersion swimming created by Terry Lachlan. And that was actually shared with me by Chris Sacca, very well-known investor now, and who learned how to swim to become a triathlete. So that's the deconstruction. Now, selection is choosing the 20%, it's 80-20. Selection is choosing the 20% of all these pieces and activities that you could do that give you 80% or more of the results that you want. So in the case of language, right, it would be that one pager for Japanese or 1,200 words for a given language really allows you to be functionally fluent. And really, I'll just give a couple of tips for that. So for Spanish, Italian, German, Michelle Thomas, Michel Thomas, Holocaust survivor, former intelligence officer, brilliant at teaching languages. They're just audio CDs. Get those for those languages. Wonderful. That is the minimal effective dose. Or VisEd flashcards, VIS hyphen ED.com, high frequency flashcards. So you get the best bang for the buck, or Duolingo. So that's selection. Duolingo.com is also really, really powerful.
Okay.
Then we move to sequencing. So golf is a good example of where people mess this up. Stan Utley, who's one of the most successful short game coaches out there, so putting and whatnot, interviewed once, and he said, you know, people come to me and they say, hey, can you fix my form? How's my form? And his response is very often, your form is fine. It's the sequence that's off. You have all the right pieces, but you're executing them in the wrong order. And that's why most people fail at most things, I think, is they're doing things out of order, whether that's a book launch or otherwise. So sequencing, I'll give you an example, like cooking the perfect steak, right? So oftentimes people are told, well, you need to sear it, get it to room temperature, sear it first, and then you cook it. Well, you could do that, but you could also, there are a couple of different ways, counterintuitive ways that you can make a perfect steak. First is to cook it sous vide. So it's a vacuum packed bag at like 135 degrees for a half hour, say. Sear it afterwards. Okay, that's one approach. And that's what like Heston Blumenthal at the Fat Duck would do, number one ranked restaurant not too many years ago in the world. But another counterintuitive approach would be, you know, instead of getting it to room temperature, you're going to do the opposite. You take the steak, you had it dry and you throw it into the freezer for 45 minutes. And you do that because the freezer is the driest environment in your entire house. That's to evaporate all the surface moisture, and then you sear it right out of the freezer, and you get the crispest, most delicious sear from the Maillard reaction because of that. So sequencing is just doing things in the right order. And then the last, this is arguably the most important. So steaks is creating a carrot or a stick so that you actually do what you're supposed to do, right? So putting the alarm clock in the other room, or drinking that one cup of coffee, getting up at 6:30, eating 30 grams of protein within 30 minutes of waking up, whatever. And there's some very easy ways to do this. So for instance, one of my favorite is a site called Stick, and I have no association with them. So stickk.com. Lyft is another option, which is an app that I'm involved with, which was incubated by the Twitter guys. But talking about Stick, you go to Stick, you describe your new behavior, you put money into escrow. I encourage people to start with something
Yeah,
that's
you were
not.
saying that George Bush was the number one recipient on that.
So the yeah right. So the punchline is you put money into escrow, and then you choose an anti-charity. And anti-charity is where your money goes if you don't do what you're supposed to do, and you have referees. Your friends will keep you honest. They'll be like, "Dude, sorry, like you didn't go to the gym twice this week. Your money's going to the George W. Bush Presidential Library, which is the most successful anti-charity at the moment." Which is hysterical, but it's really, really effective. And it doesn't have to be a lot of money. You could do a
So
betting with friends even.
let me see if I could, if I've got this. You want to deconstruct someone else's process. Number two, select the key 20% that are important, sequence, put it all in the right order, and lastly, stakes, have a reason to do it. So if I were, for example, going to take up running and say I want to run a marathon, I would ask around and say, who is the person who is least expected to have finished a marathon but did? And then I go and I talk to them, maybe a few of those people, break down their process, and then I select the top, the 20% that's most important. So maybe it's that they time their weekly runs, or maybe it's that they joined the New York Roadrunners Club and so they were forced to keep going, or some other organization. I take those 20%, I start using them in the right sequence, and to add stakes to it, I might sign myself up to a marathon in a few months so that I have to stick with this.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you could also, for instance, when you're looking for the anomalies, and I think Dave Goggins is one example. He's like a 230-pound guy who runs ultra marathons. So exactly, you would deconstruct, look at what they're doing differently. You could do that on Google. So you don't necessarily have to find them in person, but I do recommend, and I have a lot of tricks for this, but let's say looking for someone who is really good 4 or 5 years ago. So they're not in the limelight now, and then they're actually surprisingly easy and usually inexpensive to contact. The stakes I would up a little bit. So not just signing up, but signing up with maybe five friends and having, let's say, a weekly check-in on your
I see.
time, let's just say. And I would encourage you to do as much smack talking as possible.
Even set up a wiki to smack talk.
Well, that's what Ramit Sethi did, right? Gain his 15 pounds of muscle, which he'd never been able to gain. He did in 3 months. Why? Because he was going to get grief for the rest of his life if he actually didn't perform after doing so much smack talking. But yes, that's the gist of the process, and it
We only have
worked.
a few more minutes. Can we end it with a discussion of what CAFE is? What does CAFE stand for, and how does that help us even more to learn and use what we learned?
Sure. So this is the core curriculum. That's what everybody should apply. CAFE is the extra credit. This is stuff that's very helpful. So compression is so CAFE is compression, frequency, and coding. Compression is how do you take something big and condense it into the least intimidating form possible. So what I mean by that is when you're trying to learn anything, there's a predictable growth graph. It actually looks a lot like the Y Combinator startup graph, like the trough of sorrow and all this stuff. For language learning, whatever. So you're going to have plateaus, you're going to have self-doubt. And in those periods, you want to be able to return to something like my one pager for Japanese that can remove that overwhelm. So how do you take a skill and let's say put it on one page, like cooking? All right. When in
Compress it
doubt.
so that your instructions for yourself or for someone else are so simple and so short that you can keep it visible even on your desk and understand it all.
Yeah,
one
you
page.
put it on your refrigerator, whatever.
Okay.
So in the book, I give some examples of that, for like knife skills, cooking in general, whatever. But I find that very helpful. And now compression is also closely related to frequency. So frequency is looking at, just like training for a marathon and going to the gym, the brain is an organ. So you just like you're limited to, let's say, glycogen and muscles for sprint cycling, you have a limited amount of neurotransmitters that you can produce over a certain period of time, limited amount of glucose. So how do you train your brain? What's the optimal schedule, et cetera? And I look at many different examples of how to hack that, including how to cram. So that's where compression is related. So how do you take, say, 6 months of culinary school and compress all the techniques into 48 hours so you can try it in a weekend? If you want to go really nuts, I mean, it's high stress, high reward, but I look at how to do that. And then the last piece is encoding. And encoding's fun, but it's not for everybody. It's kind of for the geeks out there who really want to get into it, but it's how to, which I fall into that category, how to take slippery material, whether it's foreign vocabulary, Chinese characters, numbers, whatever, and make them easily graspable, to make them stick. And there are many different approaches. There's the very simple, like acronyms, so DIS, CAFE, those are acronyms. Those are mnemonics that help you. That is an example of encoding. You have things like, for instance, I'm from Long Island, so I'm not very refined when it comes down to it. And I always forget. I'll go to fancy dinners and I'll like grab somebody else's water or grab somebody else's bread, and it's embarrassing. So if you make like the okay signs with both hands and you look at them under the table, you can see that your right hand is a D. That means your drink is on your right-hand side, and your left hand is a B. That means your bread is on your left-hand side. So it's a good way to remember not making an ass of yourself. Then you can get sophisticated. So I look at some of the top memory competitors in the world, who like Ed Cook, who's really amazing, to see how they memorize, let's say, shuffled decks of cards, an entire deck in less than a minute. How do you do that? And the principles that you learn through examining that, even if you don't focus on cards, who cares? That can apply to everything. So memorizing really slippery stuff or just acquiring very difficult skills, and coding becomes important. But that's all bonus credit. So that's Cafe.
Cafe's bonus. It's like if you really want to make sure that you've got this, add that, add compression so that it's all on one page or easy to see, easy to digest, place, frequency. And that one was interesting to me, that if there's something new that you want to do, you won't put it on just a to-do list. You said, I'm putting it on my calendar to make sure that I do it and do it often enough, and then encoding, anchor it to what you know.
Yeah, exactly. And at the end of the day, like I said, adherence, like the what you will do determines the best method. So more is not better. Like doing all of this stuff and all these acronyms is not the best. What you will do consistently is the best, even if it's one third of that. So it's a menu to choose from.
The book is The 4-Hour Chef. I focused on just one aspect of the book, how to learn anything. But there's also the cooking part, which is really what the book's about, the living the good life, shooting your own animal, and there's a video online somewhere where you actually take the insides out of a bird.
That was a turkey, yeah. So
Turkey.
there's a lot to that side of the discussion, but I realized I wanted to become a conscious eater, and part of that was learning to forage and also harvest, kill my own meat for a period of time. And I don't consider myself a hunter, but I definitely go into exploring that because I was an anti-hunter my whole life. But I think there are lessons to be learned even if you never do that. And ultimately, I want people to be, self-reliant and to really feel self-actualized. I mean, to really sharpen the saw and to be able to master one or two things a year, not one or two things per life. So I'm excited to see what people do.
And that's what the book is about to me. How do you master one or two things at least per year, not just per lifetime? All right, the 4-Hour Chef, and of course, if you get three copies of the book, where do they send the receipt? I like that you do this stuff.
Yeah, so if you get three copies of the book, print as gifts ideally. That would be most helpful to me. And it is really I intended to be.
Print. You get more from a print copy than digital?
I'm sorry?
You get a bigger cut from the print than digital?
I get
No.
less.
Less.
So it's actually, I just designed this book to be a beautiful tactile experience. I really feel like the two-page spread is how I designed it, how I thought about the book from the start. So in any case, if you get three print copies, first of all, you could use them for lifting weights. They're very heavy. But send the receipt, the Amazon receipt, to 3books@4hourchef.com, number 3, number 4. And then you'll get a 2-hour exclusive Q&A with me after the launch. You can ask me anything.
All right, cool. And good luck making the New York Times bestseller list without Barnes and Noble and those other bookstores. We're all rooting for you.
Thanks, man. Yeah, it's gonna be a dogfight. It'll be fun.
All right, cool, bud. Thanks, Tim, and thank you all for being a part of it.
All right, thanks.